Welcome to the Wind Power News Review with me, Claire Warren, editor of Wind Power Monthly.
And me, Ian Griggs, deputy editor of Wind Power Monthly. In this new podcast format, we'll ask our regular panel of experts for their take on the big stories from our recent news coverage.
Today, we ask our panellists whether we dreamed too big on offshore wind and whether inflation is forcing the industry and policymakers to wake up to some harsh realities on pricing and deployment targets.
Following on from that, we interrogate whether the contract for difference mechanism, once seen as the gold standard, is still fit for purpose in the current inflationary environment, especially after the failed CFD auction in the UK.
And finally, the trouble at Siemens Gamesa. The turbine manufacturer and its parent company face serious challenges, but is there a point at which its financial losses become unsustainable, and who is best placed to lead it back to profitability?
It's all on the News Review podcast, a new regular series in addition to our regular episodes exploring the issues in the wind industry today.
Joining us for this news podcast to discuss some of the big industry stories, we have two expert guests who are also both regular contributors to Wind Power Monthly's analysis and opinion sections. First, we have Shashi Bala. Shashi is Director and Head of Research in Renewable Energy at the Brinkman Group.
Thank you, Claire and Ian, for having me here.
We're also joined by Will Sheard. Will is Director of Analysis and Due Diligence at consultancy firm K2 Management.
Nice to be here as well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, gentlemen. Offshore wind developers are facing huge challenges due in part to a rapid shift to a high inflation environment, with project costs leaping by 40% globally and by up to 50% in the US. Developers in Europe and the US are either delaying final investment decisions or putting projects on the back burner or desperately trying to renegotiate existing power purchase agreements and even paying large fines to exit contracts, which they say are no longer viable.
Well, I think we'll start with you on this one, if we may. Is this a blip or is it something more structural? And how long do you think these problems for offshore wind are likely to last?
Yes, I think it's probably a little bit of both a blip and something more structural. I think that the immediate shock is hopefully a blip. We have certainly seen inflation in commodities, in labour prices, etc., that I think we're seeing the signs that those peaks may have passed. But I think there's evidence, certainly in the UK industry, that the assumed cost of offshore wind was too low. We're perhaps moving into a new normal, and that's maybe where the structural shift comes a little bit more into play. How long is this likely to last? I'd like to think we're sort of through the sort of worst of that shock period. But I think now we need to sort of make the adjustments both in sort of the regulatory governmental side, in the supply chain, to sort of reset the economic landscape of projects into that and hopefully economically viable new reality. I would project that process needs to take at least 6 months, probably more like a year or so for those changes to really work themselves through. You know, obviously the industry continues during that period. And, you know, projects are still reaching financial close. There is still a lot of construction ongoing and developers, supply chain, et cetera, are making these changes as we speak. So I think the commitment is there. I think there's still a fair amount of uncertainty.
Shashi, I'd quite like to bring you in with your perhaps more of an international perspective on this. What would you say are the timeframes that we might be looking at before we can see more of a recovery?
It would essentially be a function of the macroeconomic developments and the geopolitics that's going on around in the world. If the interest rates continue to be elevated and the oil prices are continuing to be elevated, and the crisis continues with the Ukraine, and then we are also seeing with Israel and Palestine, I think there are some adverse developments, unfortunately, that's prolonging this recovery. I'm not an economist by any means, but if you look at the general developments, I think probably in the next 2-3 years, we should start to see that market stabilizing to a new normal. Developers would try to wrap their heads around what would be the new financial cost, what would be the cost of the equipment. And then the other dimension is also the supply chain ramp up. We have seen Siemens booking in $600 million just for the offshore ramp up delays. So there are different pieces in this whole puzzle that needs to be aligned before we see that new normal, probably, I would say, optimistically in between 2-3 years.
That's quite a long time. That will have some serious implications for some of the mechanisms, which we will get onto in a little bit. But I'll just hand over to Ian.
Will, do you think, is this kind of a long-term problem here in that the industry and policymakers have driven the price of offshore wind too low? And how do we come back from that?
Yes, that's probably true that, you know, some of the mechanisms around the world, the supply chain efforts to reduce costs, etc., have been very successful over the last 10 to 15 years. But I do believe that we've gone a bit too far. And so I think we're now in a situation where we are seeing rising costs. And you know, perhaps we've all been caught on the hoof a little bit like that. The regulations, the support mechanisms, et cetera, weren't really designed to deal with rising costs. You know, whether that's hubris or poor design, but I think that we're now feeling a little bit of that pain. That lack of flexibility is certainly compounding the challenges.
Shashi, do you think the price of offshore wind needs to rise really quickly in order to meet this challenge, or should other inflation-linked mechanisms be put in place to support the wind industry?
We are successful as an industry because of the cost decline that we have demonstrated in the last 10, 15 years. That's a good success story, but unfortunately, sometimes you become a victim of your own success. We were used to a sector where the price learning was about 5 to 7% year over year, and there were aberrations in the past, but that was short-lived. Now, in kind of 3 years of continuous challenges from different directions, so now we're not in a position to absorb those costs. So the industry needs to make sure that the prices are rising, and it has to all begin with the regulators becoming cognizant of these increased costs and accepting the higher bid prices. The best ways to proceed forward is indexation linked to inflation, because the time horizon of developing these offshore projects are significantly longer. Most of the projects that are reaching FID today were the projects that were awarded 4 or 5 years ago at low PPA prices. So those projects are not profitable. So they need to make sure that right from the beginning, they would have indexation clauses between the developers and the regulators. And that also goes to the upstream companies. The indexation is not new to the industry. If you look at before 2012, it was pretty common in most of the contracts. But because of the competition in the market, rise of the Chinese OEMs, the pure play companies and the pioneers in the wind industry, the OEMs especially, they were a little bit relaxed on exercising those clauses, and some of the clauses were taken out. So it's time now to bring back all those clauses into the contracts across the value chain. And also from the regulatory perspective, if the US projects thing which were canceled, whether it is South Coast or Commonwealth and Empire and the Beacon Wind, it would cost about $20 to $25 billion for the regulators. So even for them to absorb that cost, it's a big impact compared to the prices that they have signed. And the developers are not in a position. So I would say that these costs have to be spread across the value chain to make sure that this industry is sustainable. Otherwise, probably we would end up penalizing some players in the value chain.
That makes a lot of sense. This seems to be an industry which does not seem very well set up to absorb big shocks. It really does thrive on stability. Will, considering what Shashi has said, what other policy mechanisms do you think are available to support offshore wind during this, I hesitate to call it a crisis, but certainly this difficult moment?
Yeah, and I think fundamentally what investors and developers are looking for is that stability. As you say, you know, offshore wind has sort of thrived on stability. I think that's related to it's still relatively immature. It's still new. It's still quite risky. And so where stability can be achieved, that's of great value to the sort of bankability of projects. What sort of regulators and policymakers can do is to provide that stability. And I think the way that that has been provided in the past is through price support mechanisms, price guarantees, whether that's CFD, feed-in tariffs, et cetera, these mechanisms, you know, on the revenue side, provide that fixed income that is predictable and can provide a relatively low-risk business case to the project. I think that's going to remain an important part of the suite of support. You know, perhaps we were cheated a bit by a long period of low and stable interest rates.
Lulled into a false sense of security there, really, yeah.
Exactly. I think there are things that can be done to provide investment incentives for supply chain to develop capabilities, to provide incentives to developers to develop projects. We can sometimes feel a bit cheated in the offshore wind industry that we're not treated the same way as the oil and gas industry is in terms of, tax breaks, et cetera, for developments. So I think there's certainly an angle there that perhaps could be considered to make the investments more attractive and lower risk.
Do you think in terms of price, is there a sweet spot where the developers can make enough money, but obviously it works for governments as well and consumers, of course?
I think so. I think there's still sufficient headroom between the real cost of offshore wind and the sort of wholesale price of electricity that there is a fair amount of flexibility in, say, the CFD strike price or feed-in tariff rates, etc., which still look like a good deal for governments, yet still allow projects to be profitable.
Shashi, if I could just turn to you. We have talked a little bit about the international picture, but do you think that this issue that we're having in offshore is a particularly big issue for the US and the UK, or would you say it's something that is affecting the entire global market?
I think it's certainly impacting UK because globally it is by far the largest offshore market. And it has been the most mature market in terms of offshore globally. And US is the second biggest market. These two markets by far are the biggest markets globally, excluding China. So from that perspective, the impact is most pronounced in these two markets, one established, one expected to be a meaningful contributor to the global offshore market. In rest of the other markets, we have not felt that impact significantly. However, there is slippage of projects in terms of timelines, whether it is in Europe or in Asia Pac. And in Europe, it's UK, Germany, Netherlands, and Denmark. These are by far the biggest markets. So we have already seen some impact in these markets. So in the near term, near to midterm, it's certainly impacting the biggest markets. But in the midterm, I would anticipate that it is likely to impact the other emerging markets as well.
So do you think in the case of the UK in particular, with its mature market, that we have perhaps dreamed a bit big on offshore and that our targets are a little bit higher than we'll be able to achieve, certainly in the shorter term?
There is certainly a big threat that many countries will not be able to meet the targets. Namely, if you talk about UK, we had to downgrade the numbers and we foresee that between now and 2030, we would probably miss out on around 10 gigawatts of the capacity. So we're expecting about 40 gigawatts to be operational in UK by 2030. And US as well, 30 gigawatts is the target, but we would expect only 25 gigawatts to be realized in the best case scenario. So there's a downgrade of between 15 and 20% compared to the targets that we had. We were optimistic that we're going to surpass those targets just 18 months ago, but it's completely changed into a different direction, which nobody was expecting or anticipating. So that's kind of a significant shortfall. Overall, in the next 5 years, we are downgrading by about 30 plus gigawatts of offshore capacity across markets. And that roughly translates to about 120, 130 billion euro worth of investments that are downgraded. The impact is much, much bigger than what we think. However, not all of this is going out, but a majority of this would be pushed in timelines to the later half of the decade. So we would expect that there would be a material recovery. Earlier, we were anticipating a steep growth in the offshore already by 25, 26. Now that's pushed by 2-3 years because of these macroeconomic changes that we're seeing.
Do you think governments, policymakers have actually woken up to quite how far behind we're going to be on our targets?
No, I don't think so. They have realized that yet, because most of the policymakers today, they're in the firefighting mode. It's one thing is to talk about those ambitious targets, but also trying to bear in mind the reality on the ground, which is way, way different now. So I would say that they need to take that into account. New Jersey is an example where the regulators are trying to encourage developers with alternate bids. So the one is a standard bid and second is an alternate bid that is closely linked to the inflation indexation. Probably, I think some of these developed markets, they should certainly look at such levers to encourage investments into the markets.
Will, did you want to add anything to that?
Even when those targets were announced, I think they seemed optimistic and challenging. I think they look even more unrealistic now, as Shashi said. I think it's almost certain to be missed. I think it's great to have these longer, big ambitions, but I think that the sort of short term is sometimes missed. I think what we really need to see is that every year, every allocation round, we're increasing capacity, increasing capacity, increasing capacity. As Shashi says, everything gets shunted down at least by a year and we start again. It's a little bit difficult. We need to have those long-term optimistic big plans, but also keep in focus the next stages and make sure that those will continue to be successful.
Ian, was there anything you wanted to add before we move on specifically to the UK's Contracts for Difference?
Yeah, I was just thinking, to Will's point, it's great to sort of set a point on the horizon that you're kind of frantically rowing towards, but you've actually just really got to look at the detail of what's happening right in front of you as well, and that seems to have been missed.
Last month's Contract for Difference tender in the UK has been described as an abject failure by the industry, with offshore developers failing to make any bids in the auction. The wind industry warned the UK government that it set the strike price too low for the tender, making it unrealistic for developers to invest in projects, but these warnings were apparently ignored. Will, should we start with you? Would you say that the Contract for Difference was a failure?
The more interesting point, perhaps, is the part of your question about whether the government ignored the warnings, and I'm not convinced they did ignore them. There was an element of brinkmanship, perhaps. Of course, developers are going to be asking for more money. Of course, that's their job, is to lobby to increase the strike price. And I think there's an element of, let's see if they're really serious. What's the real economic cost of offshore wind? And unfortunately, I think we found it. Yes, it was a failure. What's more interesting now is to ensure that we, as in the industry and the government, can take steps to ensure that the next allocation round is not a failure and that sufficient changes are made and lessons are learned. I'm still willing to believe that offshore wind is a key strategy of the current government's energy plan, as they say. Now we just need to see that backed up by some action, I think.
That's really interesting that you say actually they weren't ignoring the warnings. They're essentially playing chicken with the wind industry, you know, and seeing who would blink first. Who won out of that? Neither side?
And you can certainly argue that it turned out not to be a great strategy. If developers had turned around and said, yes, okay, we can accept £44 a megawatt hour, you win, and we still have projects, then that would perhaps have been an acceptable outcome. But I think we know now that that couldn't have been the case. I can certainly see as well from the government side that it is problematic to dramatically increase the strike price from such a low floor. It can appear unfair to last round's bidders. You do need to retain that element of competition as well.
I think there would have been quite a lot of surprise that there were no offshore bids.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope so. Perhaps Shashi can answer that.
In theory, there were about 5 gigawatts of projects that were eligible for bidding, and none of them came forward for the bidding. The simple reason is if the cost has risen by north of 50%, and if you look at the bid prices were up by in the magnitude of 15-20%, and that's kind of not enough to offset. And we're talking about the equipment prices going up by 50%, but then we also need to look at the interest rates have also risen in the same time frame by about 400 basis points. That's also hitting the developers. So considering all of these impact in cost, it's no surprise that the developers were not in a position to go and accept that low prices.
Do you think the wind industry has the level of access that it needs to the UK government? And I ask this because in one of our earlier editions of this podcast last year, a wind industry professional told me that he thought the wind industry had been asleep at the wheel in terms of its lobbying activity of governments compared to the fossil fuel lobby, which was seeming to get everything that it wanted. And actually, I mean, if you look at some of the policy announcements, certainly in the UK over the last 9 months, it would be hard to disagree with that. Shashi, what do you think? Does the wind industry actually need a bit more of an effective lobbying game, really, to get what it needs?
We spoke about Quebec and Vineyard. These kind of bodies are doing their job. But if you look at it, whom are we competing against? If you think about the oil and gas companies, you know, the super oil majors, the wind industry today is about 130, 140 billion euro industry. We are not even one third of the revenue of the largest oil and gas company in the world. We are a much, much smaller industry. And the effectiveness of lobbying would also have a bearing on the size of the industry. So that's one of the reasons why the lobbying for the oil and gas industry, which is far more mature, they would have a little bit of a higher say in those policy decisions. though we are 4 decades old as an industry, but looking at the maturity and the industrialization point of view, we are still a very nascent sector. So I think there is still a long way for us to go in terms of lobbying and try to make sure that that messages are reaching the right policymakers. Whether we like it or dislike it, policy has been the biggest backbone for the industry and will continue to remain at least in the foreseeable future.
The UK's CFD has in the past at least been described as the gold standard. Do you think that that's still the case?
As a fundamental structure, I think it still is the gold standard, if you like. As a link from feed-in tariff through CFD to hopefully more merchant, more PPA future for offshore wind, I think it's the right way to go. I think it's fair to both developers and consumers. I think where we've exposed the weaknesses in the sort of the inflexibility to deal with rising price environment. Does it need to be reformed? I think yes. Whether that reform needs to be a real sort of nuts and bolts bottom-up reform or whether that could be achieved with a few tweaks. You know, we've heard about non-price-based elements in the auction assessments. I think we've seen that sometimes too much local content requirements, too much localization requirements can be, you know, more trouble than it's worth. Certainly some considerations around those. So there is certainly some room for an improvement in the mechanism to deal with current issues that we're seeing.
Do you have any idea of what we actually need to achieve in the next two rounds of the Contracts for Difference in order to get closer to achieving our targets?
Just looking at the 2030 target of 50 gigawatts in the UK, which I think means we need to essentially install around 30 gigawatts of new capacity by the end of the decade. Given the failure of AR5, let's say there's sort of 10 gigawatts in construction, which is probably generous. So we've essentially got 20 gigawatts left to get into operation in the next 6 years. I would say that for AR6 and 7, the majority of that capacity needs to be awarded in those two rounds to stand any chance of being in operation by 2030. So both of those rounds need to be 10 gigawatt rounds. I think the pipeline exists for that. That's not impossible, but those two rounds, AR6 and 7, will need to be sort of bumper capacity rounds.
It's not impossible, as you say, Will, but it sounds like a tall order to me.
It's a tall order, for sure.
And we're going to have to learn some lessons, aren't we, from this time round. Shashi, you mentioned earlier about the 2 to 3 years before we can expect to see some sort of recovery in terms of the very large costs that the industry is facing. That doesn't bode well for the next round of the CFD in the UK.
In terms of the timeline of the CFD, I think certainly there has to be in round 6 and round 7, as Will was alluding to, of 10 plus gigawatts in each. Anything short of 7, 8 gigawatts is disappointing for the industry, and they would certainly miss that the target. That's kind of the minimum threshold that that we're looking at. However, the key is also the macroeconomic environment. So it's probably that the regulators would not accept the steep prices as we have seen in New Jersey and in New York and Massachusetts, where the developers were asking $160, $170, where they signed for about $75, $80 per megawatt hour, which are doubling up. So there has to be a middle ground between what the developers are asking and what the regulators can afford. And if there is kind of an amicable understanding between multiple stakeholders, then we're going to see that things falling into right place already from the next round.
So it's back to that sweet spot.
This is another element of the CFD, which is perhaps a weakness, is that because it's a competitive auction, you know, developers need to keep their pricing very close to their chest right up until the bid's issued. So they can't have these open discussions about where they are and what they need the strike price to be. Because if they say, well, I need £60 per megawatt hour, developer B could come and say, okay, we can get away with 59, that's fine. And then because of the competitive element of the auction, it does breed this sort of confidentiality around the bid pricing, which I think limits the ability of the industry as a whole to lobby the government.
That's a really good point, Will. I'm going to take us on to the final section. Siemens Gamesa has been in the news a lot in the last month and for all the wrong reasons. In the summer, its parent company, Siemens Energy, said it expects to make a net loss of 4.5 billion euros this year due to the huge cost of fixing turbine failures at Siemens Gamesa. Last month, Siemens Gamesa said it will restrict the sale of its 4X and 5X onshore wind turbines while it deals with quality control issues. And meanwhile, if this wasn't enough, at least two US law firms are threatening a securities fraud probe against Siemens Energy after its disclosure of widespread turbine failures at Siemens Gamesa prompted the parent company's share price to crash. Now, these law firms are investigating whether Siemens Energy issued false or misleading statements, their words, or simply failed to disclose information which is relevant for investors. Now, in response to the news story we wrote, Siemens Energy told Wind Power Monthly that the company is yet to receive any lawsuits, and it stated, the mere fact that the share price losses were high does not constitute a legal breach of duty. The entrepreneurial scope for decision-making was always respected.
Western turbine firms are already suffering as a result of the issues that we mentioned earlier, high inflation, supply chain issues, most making a financial loss. Do you think that the issues that Siemens Gamesa is now facing put it in an even more precarious position perhaps than its competitors?
It's certainly at a disadvantaged position, and that's clearly reflected in the order intake of the company. So just to take 2022, Siemens Gamesa onshore was about 3.8 gigawatts, while Nordex is about 6.5 gigawatts. So that is clearly reflected in their lower commercial competitive position. I would expect that it would continue to be so, at least in the next 1 to 2 years before they start fixing the problems. In terms of technology, time to market of the product is where Siemens Gamesa failed miserably on the 5X platform. So they cramped the development timelines without a proper diligence on the technology and the testing of the components. We also can understand when Siemens Gamesa was the only one that didn't have a competitive offering in the low wind speed segment, which was the most volume segment in the market. They were also under time pressure to commercialize that product, and that is hitting them the hardest now, and especially when it comes to the components and warranty cost. It is not new to the industry. I mean, the last 15 years, 20 years, there have been several turbine OEMs and component suppliers that have become a victim of such kind of product reliability issues. You know, we were talking about 200, 250 million for companies like Vestas, Siemens in the past was an acceptable number. But the numbers that we're speaking today is significantly higher than those. They're also racing against time to fix some of those challenges, which would compromise not only their current profitability, but also the future profitability. As you also said, Claire, your profitability has dwindled for the turbine OEMs. And on the turbine side, most part it is negative between 5 and 20%. It's the service business that's making money for almost all the OEMs. And now for Siemens, that service margins will also be compromised going forward.
Do you think there's a point at which the financial losses that are being made at Siemens Gamesa are enough to become unsustainable, to threaten either the renewables business at Siemens Energy or, in fact, to threaten Siemens Energy itself?
I don't think that it would be a threat to Siemens Energy or Siemens in general. It is certainly a bottleneck. They need to immediately address those challenges in order to come out of the woods sooner. But in the mid to long term, in the overall energy ecosystem, I think these large industrial conglomerates for the likes of Siemens and GE, they play a pivotal role in accelerating the energy transition. I would still tend to believe that it will be an important pillar in the overall Siemens portfolio. And what we have seen in aviation industry, you know, steam turbines and aviation turbines, the top 2-3 companies contribute to more than 90% of the global market share. We would expect that within the energy ecosystem, all these large companies would play a very prominent role.
Well, is there anything that you wanted to add to that?
Siemens has a very strong track record in the development of good and reliable wind turbines, and we need them to continue to do so if we're going to achieve the growth targets that we need, particularly in the offshore wind space.
Of course.
A key player. I certainly hope that that is the case. I'm glad to hear what Shashi says about the longer-term prognosis. I suppose what I would say, coming from a sort of more engineering background and a bit more focused on the technology development, is an advantage, which I will caveat in a second, the situation is, I think we're seeing from all three major offshore wind OEMs, particularly the European and US OEMs, is this a refocusing on the existing portfolios and a slowdown in this arms race of larger capacities. I think that's beneficial to the industry in terms of, you know, stabilizing price, stabilizing technology developments and bankability of new technology. The key caveat to that is the threat from the Chinese OEMs who are not slowing down on development of their larger turbines. We still need to see how those suppliers can enter the European projects and potentially not just European projects, but maybe even more so the, you know, emerging pipeline of projects in Korea, Japan, Taiwan, etc., and indeed Australia. If we ignore China, I think it's a positive thing that, you know, just slowing down a bit on technology developments from the European OEMs. But I think with the entrance of China on the horizon, I think that means that perhaps Siemens, Vestas and GE don't have as much space as they might like to consolidate their position, let's say.
Will, in situations like this where so many things seem to have gone so wrong and so quickly, you often see changes at the top. Are we likely to see a change in leadership at Siemens Gamesa?
I don't know. You know, I think it's often, you know, the people who have the experience of the issue are often the best placed to solve it in some respects. And I know that Siemens is, you know, being such a large organization, does have this slightly more political structure where the optics are important, that perhaps that change in leadership does, you know, you can usher in a fresh, you know, fresh approach and a fresh strategy, etc. And that, that can be an easier transition. So I think the kind of the more political optics can be easier. I'm not necessarily convinced that the practical application of the solutions is easier with a change at the top. In some cases, that could be a step backwards. You know, I wouldn't want to predict what's likely to happen at Siemens. I'm sure it's being considered.
Shashi, what do you think?
Regardless of anybody taking those positions, you need to give them at least 2.5 to 3 years to turn around the company, because they have gone to the rock bottom, if I may. Then you need to allow them the time to pull all the levers available at their disposal and think of innovative solutions to turn around the company. To a certain degree, the problems have arisen also to do with that frequent change in leadership at the company. When Gamesa was a standalone company prior to integrating with Siemens, the onshore division was profitable by 1 billion euros. And today, the onshore is lost by 2 billion euros. So it's kind of a wipeout of 3 billion value after the integration. And partly that's to do with the frequent changes in the leadership, because when new people take over, new set of strategies come into play, and then the organization is going in different directions. And I personally do not think that changing the leadership would be a better solution, because maybe they would be under pressure from shareholders to bring out immediate results. But even if it is new management, they're not coming with a magic wand to turn the company from 2 billion losses to 2 billion profit in a year or 2 years. These are large companies, 10, 15 billion euro companies. To turn them profitable is not an easy task. So I would say they should more focus on the operational execution.
Finally, Will, you alluded to this earlier in your answers. Siemens Gamesa is the example we're using here, but there's a wider question around all the Western turbine companies. And with stiff competition coming from Chinese manufacturers, should the EU or the US step in to save one if it becomes necessary?
Yeah, I do think that in the current landscape with geopolitics, with the macroeconomic situation, I do think that governmental intervention should be on the table. In terms of a targeted bailout of one supplier, that's not yet necessary and perhaps not the best solution. I think what I probably prefer to see is a more broad package of support for the suppliers operating in particular jurisdictions to allow them to compete, whether that's through actually positive support or through sort of more protectionist policies that restrict or, you know, limit the ability of others to come into that market. Either way, I think a leveling of the playing field is probably warranted. We've seen through the IRA in the US, the Green Deal in the EU, I think that the kernels of those ideas starting to develop. I do think that should be on the table. European OEMs, particularly Vestas, Siemens Gamesa and GE, they've put in a lot of effort. They've been a driving force in the industry. To put that at risk would be a big mistake.
Broadly, Shashi, do you agree with that?
The company should find out their own ways to come out of these challenges, because it's a level playing field for every player. There should not be advantages and the other should be at a disadvantageous position. So broadly, if there is a stable policy mechanism then automatically companies will find their way out of those challenges. So just because a company is financially constrained doesn't mean that a state has to step in to favor that company. Of course, it has to protect the broader supply chain, because we're only talking essentially about 4 or 5 companies globally, excluding China, contributing to 95% market share. If one supplier has fallen to the ground, then that has a big ripple effect on the whole industry. But I would say it is probably not necessary and not warranted at this juncture. And they should give time for Siemens to resurrect itself.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's all we have time for today. But I just want to say thanks very much to both our expert guests. Shashi Bala, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Will Sheard, thank you very much indeed for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you both for joining us.
You've been listening to the Wind Power News Review with Claire Warren and Ian Griggs, looking at the big stories over the last month. To hear more from Wind Power, you'll find us wherever you download your podcasts. For more news, comment, and analysis of the wind industry, visit windpowermonthly.com.